Peter Fleming, professor and author of The Mythology of Work, offers a sharp, articulate, and authoritative critique of neoliberal economics. His tone occasionally veers into that of an angry blogger, with a few surprising expletives to match. But Fleming's insights and startling connections lift this potential polemic to a more worthy, enduring level. His take on the human capital theory is fresh and compelling, as are his perceptions about the growing trends of uberization and quit-lit. Cynical, angry, frustrated, and armed with a ton of references, Fleming convincingly smites the orthodoxy. You'll cheer the way he points out the problems with current economic theories and their, according to Fleming, destructive applications. Although those who disagree will gain considerable information, they're likely to decry a lack of comprehensive alternatives and solutions. Neoliberal economics. Even after the capitalist excess, unchecked greed, and free market hubris that exploded into view in 2008, the conventional wisdom of neoliberal economics remains relatively intact. The financial crisis and economic depression of the 1930s decimated the wealth of the ruling classes. In response, the government reformed much of the financial system. But in contrast, the wealthy have only gotten richer in the years since 2008. The speculative habits of the financial sector are largely unchanged. Meanwhile, the left's arguments about policy and reform seem weak and unfocused. This enables their opponents to pigeonhole them as living in the past. Prioritizing business interests. The assumption that governments must prioritize the interests of companies and maximize their ability to employ people, whatever the work and whatever the business, is a gospel economic tenet of Western culture. This attitude celebrates more individuals having jobs, even if the jobs are unrewarding and unproductive. It also honors higher GDP, even if the output numbers include speculation, extractive business models, and other dubious activities. For this mainstream neoclassical paradigm to hold up theoretically, analysts make basic assumptions about how people behave and extrapolate those assumptions onto unrealistic and abstract econometric models. Positing a theory that turns self-interest and profit into the driving force of all economies requires creating a mythical, unrealistic figure, Homo economicus, the rational economic man. Human capital theory. The human capital theory, HCT, which first appeared in the 1960s, has powerfully altered daily life. This concept regards a person as similar to a small, individual corporation. As the name of the theory suggests, it considers each individual's education and skills as his or her capital, the assets each participant in the economy has on hand to deploy. The previous mindset held that higher education benefits society, so society should pay for it. But the thinking around HCT and Homo economicus maintains that if a person earns more money because of being a college graduate, then that person should contribute toward getting that degree. The transition to tuition fees in British universities is a clear manifestation of a movement toward HCT. Lecturers and students once had the time and space to be curious and to experiment with ideas. Now universities focus on a factory-like output of commoditized units of human capital, ready to compete in the job market. Under HCT, a company shouldn't take the risk of paying for training that gives employees transferable skills and makes them more employable. HCT has helped change the conventional labor relationship into today's individualistic, agent-type universe, a sharp contrast with previous generations' idea of an embedded, loyal company employee. The present day's self-interested, transient views of workers aligns with neocapitalism's deregulated, entrepreneurial approach to business theory. Bonus compensation tied to share value is another HCT outcome. Ultra-responsible autonomy. For low earners, HCT helped create ultra-responsible autonomy, the divisive notion that people are entirely accountable for their own economic fate. Previous generations may have expected their government to make sure the economy offered a supply of suitable jobs. They may also have anticipated that the companies they worked for would keep them employed for life. Today, if you aren't doing well in the job market, employers are likely to blame you for not adequately managing your human capital. This individualist narrative ignores the fact that an economy provides a certain number of low-skill occupations based on technology and consumer demand, rather than the economy reflecting or supporting the human capital of its workforce. personal ownership of failure. For some workers, the popular political storyline of empowerment results instead in owning their own economic failure. You see this most disturbingly in downsized ex-employees who bravely and with outward cheer accept the crushing blow. This brings to mind battered spouses who fault themselves for angering their mates. Fired workers internalize rejection and know that expressing displeasure won't help them get a new job. Extractive capitalism. Supporters of the existing model of capitalism cheer competition and profit. In their eyes, markets govern a system that shares the rewards of risk-taking and innovation. The working man or woman feels the pressure of a competitive job market, while corporate CEOs get golden handshakes when they fail, and bankers receive bailouts from the government, even as they destroy the economy. Many highly paid elites live in a cushy marketplace of chummy, socialistic networks. Executive pay is ballooning, even as studies show that a CEO's net impact on an organization is small. Chance, external events, and market trends have a greater effect on how a company fares. The new wave of tech companies, despite their California progressive image, aggressively avoid paying taxes, function with an egotistical mindset, and express contempt for traditional notions of the welfare state. The Silicon Valley giant's anti-authoritarian outer vibe masks steely post-Reagan individualism. Large companies now spend less on R&D, and even the biggest firms benefit from past government-funded research. As R&D has dropped, the share of profits that companies in the United Kingdom pay their shareholders has increased from 10% in 1970 to 70% today. Private landlords. A large share of Britain's income ends up in the pockets of private landlords, who make a negligible entrepreneurial contribution to society. Many low-paid workers, often the employees of big companies, rely on housing subsidies to survive. Private landlords now indirectly benefit from £9.3 billion, $12.2 billion, per year in taxpayer-supported housing aid, an amount that has doubled since 2005. Wreckage economics. Asset capture is replacing innovation in this new wreckage economics. Companies and capitalists as a whole care little for creativity. They seek other, already existing ways to extract assets, perhaps by shutting out competitors or through aggressive patenting. Rather than produce new products or services, the wreckage economics route is to take over an established business, largely by using debt, thus avoiding taxes, and then squeeze it dry. The public good. The concepts of the public good and the public sphere have come under attack in recent decades. People now take it for granted that private companies and consumer spending are good, while public services and public tax-funded spending are bad. Free market competition can be unattractive to large companies, especially when they can feed off the taxpayer instead. The public sphere remains the last pool of value that hasn't been sapped dry by the corporate takeover of society over the last 20 years. Outsourcing public services to private industry destroys a structure of management expertise and supervision. Given the complexity of the contracts involved, this often means hiring expensive consultants, which defeats any attempts at cost savings. These faux privatization arrangements, such as that of the British train system, for example, often leave the downside risks at the taxpayer's door. But if all goes well, private investors gain. Uberization. Uber's business practices highlight a pattern affecting many jobs. Such platforms, which Silicon Valley is spinning as part of the new sharing economy, can turn out to be pernicious to those who provide the hands-on services. Offering a service for a lower cost usually means that the competitive pressure bears down on workers' incomes. As the gig economy grows, being Uber screwed resonates with more and more people. Uber applies malevolent insights from behavioral economics and the nudge philosophy to get more hours from its drivers. For example, to keep drivers behind the wheel longer, texting managers will pretend to be female to gain drivers' acquiescence more easily. These managers will emphasize a driver's lost wages from signing off rather than the potential extra earnings for staying on the road. Looking more closely at these platforms means realizing that they are producing nothing new, but are instead enclosing a segment of transactions and trying to corner markets and extract cash. As normal employment disappears, other things disappear along with it, including minimum wage protections, sick pay, and holiday pay. An analogy helps explain the shift. In terms of work, fewer people are in stable marriages and more are having one-night stands. Government should protect the growing army of self-employed workers from a competitive race to the bottom. The jilted generation. Maintaining or improving a middle-class lifestyle proved fairly easy for Britain's baby boomers, with their free education, plentiful bourgeois jobs, and helpful housing market. For millennials, the wealth and bequests of their relatives matter. Debt, often from student loans, high rents, or outlandish mortgages, is the new normal. The jilted generation features increasing numbers of graduates and diminishing numbers of graduate-level jobs. Employers put more pressure on white-collar employees. Getting a job in the most desirable sectors may now require first serving unpaid internships. High-paying, attractive industries have an accepted culture of extended work hours. More middle-class professions, such as that of university lecturer, are falling victim to these more insecure conditions. Economic anxiety. The old hierarchical corporate model actually required less management than today's greater autonomy and heavier emphasis on subcontracting. Authoritarianism in the workplace is back. In some areas, it never went away. With the ethos of a paternalistic company now mostly a thing of the past, managers find that it's almost a badge of honor to enforce low wages and economic anxiety. Employees face attacks from all sides, as corporate efficiencies foment customer dissatisfaction, and bosses use dissatisfied clients to bully employees. Companies exploit managers' appraisals to divide and rule the staff. The worst examples are the anonymous, uninhibited critiques of Amazon staff members, and the feedback from capricious students that roasts university lecturers and undermines academics' traditional autonomy. Quit lit. The burdens of office life and of clinging to a middle-class existence cause stress and burnout. Payday loan companies, the self-help industry, and the growing attraction of radical lifestyle changes have all arisen from this angst. The literary phenomenon of quit lit presents fantasies of embarrassing or cursing your boss, becoming an internet sensation, or escaping into a new life. All right there on your phone on the way home in the subway. A worthy life. Unlike colleagues in the old-fashioned unionized workplace, employees today don't share common experiences or seek mutual resolutions. Society must open a debate about what matters for human beings and how working people should live. This new paradigm should recognize that money is only the means, not the end, toward a sound society and a worthy life.